Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Portland City Council. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce a couple of students who are here with us from Spain. I'd like to welcome Ana Fernandez de Cordoba and Manuel Acido Rico to Portland. Could you folks stand? Oh, there they are in the back, behind the clock. Anna's from Madrid, and this is her first trip to the United States. Manuel is also here in Portland this month. Well, both of them are staying with host families, and they take English classes downtown to improve their fluency. They're both interested in becoming lawyers. God bless them. And this morning, they are job shadowing with Deputy City Attorney Shane Abma. Though they may, they thought they'd like to see City Council in action, and I have a hunch that you're going to see some interesting action this morning. Again, welcome to Portland.
Mayor, may I just add one note to that?
Please.
I'd also like to welcome you on behalf of my family. My wife's family hails from Cordova, and my mother-in-law is Maria Carmen Gomez, now Carmen Schechter. But we travel to Spain every other year to see family. So we welcome you, and I hope you'll swing by the office later so we can visit.
The council is open. Could you please call the roll?
Fish?
Here.
Leonard? Saltzman?
Here.
Potter?
Here.
I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity they are authorized to represent. I'd also like to say something to the folks holding all the signs. You can hold them in front of your face, but not over your head, and obstructing the vision of people behind you. So please keep that in mind. Please read the first communication.
Item 957, request of Lee Pate to address council regarding the Sit Lie Camping Law. Lee Pate.
Please call the next name.
958, request of Lee Iacuzzi to address council regarding gender discrimination. It's Lee Iacuzzi.
Please read the next.
959, request of Douglas Peterson to address council regarding Peterson's lease at 10th and Yamhill Garage.
Please come forward, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you for allowing me to appear before the City Council.
Mr. Peterson, you have 3 minutes.
Yes.
And please state your name for the record.
Douglas Peterson.
Thank you.
Yes. And thank you very much. I own three stores, convenience stores, 24-hour stores in downtown Portland. I've been in business 23 and a half years. I think I'm a pretty good operator. Last year, our sales were almost $3 million, $2,800,000. Of that, $1,400,000 of that was at our Morrison store, which we have lost our lease and are being asked to leave by August 15th. And I feel very aggrieved. I feel devastated. I feel I am a good merchant. I think there's some perceptions out there that just are not true, and it's certainly not my customers' perceptions. I've had customers sign petitions, and there's a comment section in the petitions. I have over 2,600 signatures, many of them with comments, which I would urge you to read. They're very interesting comments. Landmark location, an asset to the community, staple, needed, a needed institution, part of Portland, part of the community, part of the character of the city, vital to livable downtown, a resource to the neighborhood. Downtown needs 24-hour convenience stores, needed when so many people live in apartments with no cars. So, only 24-hour store in the area, live in neighborhood, work at night, feel safer waiting for Max because there's a man's store there. It's on my commute, close to school. Your employees, good employees, friendly employees, need for small business. And it goes on and on. And the perception is that I'm causing the homeless problem and the riffraff in the neighborhood. And frankly, if you go, you see them everywhere where there's a high traffic pattern. And this is a Max stop right at the end of the Fairless Square. There's people, every third train is yellow train where people are getting off the train. and there's people waiting for the train. My stores are very busy, customers lined up, usually one right after another, all day long and evening long, and being checked out. And so there's a good place to panhandle. And it's difficult for business owners to control people on the street, which is perceived as public property. And you go to McDonald's, Rite Aid Drug, Pioneer Place, Pioneer Square, Starbucks at Pioneer Square, any place there's traffic, and you find some of these people. And I feel I'm not the attractor. It's just the general traffic. There's a study that was done for TriMet, and the study was of the new bus mall and what they expected to have in the new bus mall. Encouraged property owners to open more urban-centric enterprises such as newsstands and any available nooks. The same study for TriMet said that they need for vendor carts, sidewalk cafes, as well as 24-hour convenience stores on the new mall. I have facts and figures here that there's a packet that we'll share with you. And in there, all how much I paid for taxes and such over 10 years. But an interesting is lottery. The lottery, 18% of the lottery sales is what actually goes to various government issues. And I've contributed over the last 8 years, and this is per the Lottery Commission, $887,800 that has gone. Two-thirds of it going to K through 12 schools, 7.5% to parks, 7.5% to watershed, and that's what my stores have contributed to the lottery for the lottery. And that's the 18% share that is distributed.
Mr. Peterson, your time is up.
Oh, okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your any help I can.
If you wish to leave the signatures, please leave them with the council clerk.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. And I have a packet. Should I leave them with the packet, too, for what packet for each of you?
That's yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please read the next name.
Item 960, request of David G. Gwyther to address council regarding Peterson's store.
Gwyther, please come forward.
Well, my name is David G. Gwyther, and I'm a lobbyist for Peterson's and a consultant.
Please sit down, sir. Thank you.
I would like to concede two of my minutes, if possible, to Mr. Peterson.
No.
Okay. I was called. I came into the newspaper stand. I've been living in downtown Portland for 25 years. I read a lot of newspapers, and I noticed that he had a problem. And I thought I might be able to help him in interacting with city government and various agencies. So I came in and presented myself. I used to own a store in downtown Eugene. It was urban removal, as we called it in those days. They left a hole in the street or in the area where the building was for close to 15 years that was fenced in and it just became filled with water. That was not a good example of good urban planning. Now, I know that the city has plans to renew that whole district and to upgrade the parking structure. Those plans can be implemented once you have the funds. Mr. Peterson would like to work with the city and various agencies to make those plans come true. There's things that we can do with the parking garage in terms of card locks, etc., for getting in and out of the parking garage. The architecture of the parking garage itself lends itself to the kind of activities that some people perceive as being destructive to the downtown. In the stairwells, et cetera, that's something that Mr. Peterson doesn't really have a lot of control over. We're looking into getting additional security at night. The security, there is a tremendous amount because the security guards drink coffee, stop in. We have Whack and Hut basically parked outside during the max hours, so we're looking at, a 12 to 5 gap there. Possibly a drive-by security unit would work. He's installed a video monitoring system, which has worked in other industries like the cab industry, so that those people who are misbehaving realize that they're on video camera and could possibly self-correct. I know that there are issues that are involved in downtown. Downtown is going through probably the biggest rebuilding program in the history of Portland. We're going from hotels that used to rent for $6 a night or $60 a night to hotels that rent for $400 a night. That new one on top of the Macy's is going to be quite upscale. And I realize that the council wants to encourage more upscale activity, but you still have to have the sort of convenience store that's available to people who work odd hours. Myself, I had a paper route when I was young. I get up at 5 in the morning, and sometimes I want to read the paper. So I go down, I can buy it at Peterson's. I don't have to wait for Starbucks or some other place to open up. And that's a very convenient situation for downtown workers. There's also people working all night. So what we'd ask for is a 6-month extension.
Thank you. That's it?
That's it.
Okay. You're excused. Is that all of the communications?
That's all.
Okay. Move to the consent agenda. Does any commissioner wish to pull any item from the consent agenda? Before we move to the consent agenda, there is one other individual who wished to make a statement. Mr. Robert King, could you please come forward? He's the president of the Portland Police Association. King, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mayor Potter. Mayor Potter, City Council. I'm here to testify today to share with you some information about some of the conditions in the Portland Police Bureau. My name is Robert King. I'm the president of the Portland Police Association. I'm here to give you the lay of the land as to how things stand with your police officers. I've been a police officer in Portland for 19 years, and I can tell you that I've honestly never seen morale as low as it is at its present. It's a combination of several things that have gotten us to this stage. First, it's staffing. Cities of Portland size have on the average 2.5 officers per 1,000 citizens. In Portland, we're well below the 2 per 1,000. We need to hire at least 300 officers to even approach appropriate staffing levels. When you add in the fact that we try to follow a community policing model, it's that's very officer intensive. We're out there every day trying to do too much with too few officers. Today we have only 380 officers assigned to routine street patrol duties in the city, and that's approaching a population of about 600,000. Our officers are tired and they're worn out. The second issue is pay. Every officer working for you today knows about the recent Seattle police settlement. That has Seattle police officers receiving a raise of at least 25% over a 4-year contract. That'll put Seattle's starting pay at $64,000 and its top pay at $90,000. Portland will be more than $20,000 below these numbers. There have been several wage settlements in the country along the same range. Long Beach has recently settled for a 24% raise, San Francisco for a 21% raise, Oakland 22%, Honolulu 24%, and all over 4 years. Phoenix just gave its officers a 13% raise over 2 years. Until recently, Portland was the highest paid police agency in the state, but this is no longer true, and our members know it. We already can't recruit enough officers. We've lowered our educational requirements, et cetera, and we're facing a recruiting crisis, I think, in the very near future. Lastly, we have some serious working condition issues that have arisen in the police bureau. We learned only 2 weeks ago that the bureau was adopting what it called optimal staffing, something that really translated into denying officers vacation, already limited vacation days that they can take off during the summer. The police bureau didn't involve us in any of the discussions on the issue, and we only found out about it after the fact when our officers started angrily calling us at the union. We have approached the bureau about making changes to improve working conditions, things like sleep deprivation, fixing the court scheduling system, dealing with the parking problem for Central Precinct, but no one seems to be willing to talk with us seriously about implementing any of these. All that to say simply that we need your support. We know that you're working on the vacation issue, and we appreciate your efforts on that front. We hope that that signals a new willingness to listen, to care, and to act to help us support the critical police services that Portlanders deserve. Your officers are committed, and they're brave, and they're professional, and they're keeping our community safe, and they need your support. There are problems in the police bureau, and I'm hoping that you'll work with me to solve some of them. Thank you.
Back to the consent agenda. Do any commissioners wish to pull any items from the consent agenda? Does any member of this audience wish to pull any particular item from this consent agenda? Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read the 9:30 time certain.
Item 961, Willamette River Combined Sewer Overflow Program Update to City Council.
Commissioner Adams.
Thank you, Mayor Potter. We, at the initiation of my tenure as Commissioner in charge of the Bureau of Environmental Services, we committed ourselves to provide regular updates to the City Council regarding the Combined Sewer Overflow Program, the $1.4 billion project to prevent sewer overflows into the Willamette River. And today we're going to be getting just such an update. So we will begin with BES Director Dean Marriott.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mayor, members of the Council. I am Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director. With me is Paul Gribben, who's our Chief Engineer in charge of the tunnel projects. And as the Commissioner indicated, we have committed to come before you at least twice a year to give you an update on the status of the projects associated with cleaning up the Willamette, and today is one of those events. Just to refresh your recollection on the timeline, we began this odyssey back in 1991, and when we signed a 20-year agreement to commit the city to spend the resources to and do the work necessary to finish the job of cleaning up the Willamette River and the Columbia Slough. And as you can see, we're about 17 years into that program, approaching the conclusion of it. And a lot of people are very interested in how we stack up against what other cities in the country are doing. This is just a representative sample. There are literally hundreds of cities around the country that are wrestling with how to proceed with the Combined Sewer Overflow Abatement Program. There are over 800 cities dealing with this problem today. One of the nice things about this chart is that, as you can see, we will actually be finished well before most of the major cities of the country that are still dealing with it. Just to refresh your recollection again on the three legs of the stool that we have embarked on. The first is the Cornerstone Project. That's taking stormwater out of the combined system. After all, I'm sure as you recall, it's not that we don't have adequate sewage treatment capacity for handling our normal waste flows. It's the rain that fills up the collection system that's the problem. So we embarked on an effort to get as much of the rainwater out of the sewer system as we could. We've called those efforts the Cornerstone Projects. Most of those are finished, but some of them, like the downspout disconnection, continues, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. The other leg of the stool is the Columbia Slough projects. Those were done early, and we can recall Commissioner Saltzman walking in the tunnel before we put it into service when the construction was completed. The Columbia Slough has been essentially free from combined sewer overflows since about the year 2000, so we have seen a dramatic improvement in water quality in the Columbia Slough. And the third leg of the stool is the Willamette River projects. You're all familiar with the completion of the West Side Tunnel project, and we're here today mostly to report to you on the progress on the East Side project, which is the last major element of the program. Next, you'll see the slide, which we'd like to show, that shows the progress on the removal and treatment of combined sewer overflows. If you go back as far as the 1970s, the city discharged about 10 billion gallons a year of combined sewage into the Willamette and the Columbia Slough. When we signed the order with the state back in the early 90s, we had already cut that number to about 6 billion. And the glide path since then has been down steadily. We've made reductions since the early 90s of about two-thirds of the volume. So we're down around 2 billion gallons now, and that will be controlled when the East Side Tunnel comes online. We will still have an occasional discharge during heavy rain events, and that is permissible under the federal and state guidelines. Just to talk a little bit about the schedule, we started with 55 combined sewer overflow outfalls into the slough and the river. The first thing we did was control the 13 outfalls into the Columbia Slough, as I mentioned, December of 2000. We completed that. 7 of the outfalls on the river were taken out of service in December of 2001. The West Side Tunnel involved the control of 16 outfalls on the west side of the Willamette. Those were controlled by December of 2006, right on schedule. And the final leg of this marathon is slated for December of 2011, which will mark the control of the remaining 19 outfalls to the Willamette. I'm now going to turn it over to Paul Gribben, who will give you some specifics about the East Side Tunnel operation.
Good morning. I'm Paul Gribben, Chief Engineer in charge of the CSL Tunnel Program. That just gives you an overview of the route of the tunnel right now, and the part in red is the part that's been completed. So overall, it's 6 miles long, and as far as the tunneling is concerned, we're approaching the halfway point fairly soon, by October. Project status right now, the tunnel boring machine itself is across the street from the Rose Garden. It's at the steel bridge shaft, and it's already broken out of the steel bridge shaft, and it's on its way up under the railroad corridor. The next stop will be the River Street shaft, which will be in October, and it'll go further on to the Port Centerway shaft. Currently, on the contract itself, we're a little bit beyond 50% complete now. We're currently ahead of schedule, about 2 months ahead of schedule. And the production of the tunnel itself, it continues to exceed our expectations. We actually had to add additional segment manufacturing for the tunnel lining itself to keep up with the progress of the TBM. We did have a serious injury in the tunnel about a month back. There was immediate work stoppage. Changes were made to the contractor's procedure in the tunnel. The worker is now back on modified duty and will be returned to regular duty as soon as possible. This is our current project expenditures. The dashed blue line on top is the cumulative cost flow curve that we anticipated back in 2006. The green line is our actual cost to date. And you can see we're trending under where we originally projected to be as far as cost was concerned. The orange line is looking from today forward to the end where we expect to be along the route. So we do expect right now, if everything holds the way it's been, that we are going to come in under the original contract amount. As far as local business participation, in the first 27 months of the contract, there have been 170 local subcontracts awarded. 138 of them have been with minority women or emerging small businesses. So far, we've contracted over $23 million in MWSB contracts. The contractor's goal was 26, so right now they are way ahead of where they expected to be, and they're living up to their commitment to us for that. We've also got over $13 million in other local subcontracts. Risk management will continue to be an important part of what we're doing. We meet quarterly to review a list of all the project risks. As we've passed major milestones, including mining under the Banfield interchange, we cross those risks off. We add new ones if we see them coming, and we're adjusting our contingency dollars down as we go. And there will be an outside financial audit here fairly soon. The procurement process is about to begin. We still have a lot of work to do in the Central East Side, and it's probably our biggest challenge, is keeping all the businesses in operation. It's one of our central focuses. We do have, unfortunately, we'd like to be able to slowly come to the end, but it's not going to happen. We have several other projects that also have to come in at about the same time. Additional work at the pump station, the Portsmouth Force Main, all have to come together before we can tie in the outfalls on East Side. So all those are currently on schedule, but we do have a fair amount of work that has to complete at about the same time. And we have one more outfall to tie in on the west side, which is the Balch Consolidation Conduit. Public involvement will continue to be our focus, especially in the Central East Side, and so is continual communication with the Central East Side businesses, traffic notifications, signs, and meetings. And we're also starting to implement our community benefit opportunities approved project list. With that, that's all we have, but we do have a report from the East Side CSO Review Committee from Bill Martinak, who is the acting chair.
Be happy to take any questions if you'd like, or we can come back after you hear from Bill.
Why don't you come back after Bill?
Okay, thanks.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Bill Martinek. I'm the I guess I'm the acting chairman now. I've been before you before with two of the three previous reports to the council, and due to the retirement of Mr. Wilson, I've been asked to follow on and serve as the chair. So Tuck has set some pretty high standards for me to follow, so I feel a little bit like a small college player trying to take over for Michael Jordan, but I'm going to do the best I can, so bear with me. The review committee was initially appointed by the council in 2006, and our charges at that time were to meet on at least a quarterly basis, which we've exceeded that. We're basically meeting on about a bi-monthly schedule. We are set to monitor the environmental services efforts on the project and their relationship with the general contractor, KBB. Also, we were asked to provide a forum for discussion of any of the pertinent issues that came up as the project progressed, and then also to communicate with the City Council on a regularly scheduled bi-yearly, so every 6 months we're before you. To date, we have held 17 meetings, and we have a very dedicated group of committee members that that spend time at each meeting reviewing the reports that are put out on a monthly basis by the general contractor. And so we spend quite a bit of time reviewing all of the various aspects of the project. For work progress, since our last report, which was in October of 2007, the project has continued along the critical path, which is the main shaft construction. Last summer, there was a impact occurrence that happened with a seal failure, and that has been mitigated, and the schedule has recovered since then, and actually, as Paul said, has become slightly ahead of schedule. At this point in time, the project is approximately 48% complete and is scheduled at this point in time to finish approximately 8 weeks ahead of schedule. So the project is proceeding in a timely manner. Paul also mentioned that there was an accident in the tunnel, and so we discussed that at our last meeting and the steps that have been taken to provide some remedial training for the crews down there to address the causes of that injury, and also to retrain some of the workers down there to prevent any accidents in the future. Also, the contractor has an extremely dedicated quality control program in place, which is tracking what's being built and also tracking the segment construction that'll be used in the rest of the tunnel, and everything there points that quality is a very, very high aspect of what the contractor is providing for the City of Portland. Also, as Paul mentioned, the subcontracting and diversity requirements are being met well ahead of schedule on the contract. There have been over $23 million in subcontracts that have been awarded to local, small, minority, and emerging businesses. And also the apprenticeship training program with a 20% goal is being exceeded at this time. So the general contractor is doing an outstanding job of meeting those requirements of the City of Portland. At this time, approximately $185 million of the budget has been expended, and with the graph that was presented earlier, shows that it's very close tracking to the original budget for the project. The overall general impression from the committee is that the project is succeeding in all of its expectations, that it is moving very smoothly with very small impact outside of what was planned to be a major impact to the east side area of Portland, and that the contractor is working diligently with the east side neighborhoods to make sure that any impacts to the neighboring businesses and the traveling public there are kept to an absolute minimum. And from what we're seeing is the committee, they're doing an outstanding job for the complexity of the project and the area that they have to work in over there. All of the area shaft sites have extremely small footprints, and in order to get their work done there, they've done an extremely good job of scheduling and making sure that there is as small of impact as possible on the east side neighborhoods that they're working in. We will continue to meet. We will probably schedule another tour of the project later this summer, early in the fall, to track the progress. And then we'll also be scheduling to come back before you again in about 6 months with another updated report to you of the committee's actions and activities.
Well, I just, Bill, I want to thank you for volunteering your time to this effort of oversight, citizen independent oversight of the project. It's I know it takes a lot of time and effort and concentration away from you and your fellow committee's livelihoods and families, so thank you. I appreciate that. So just to summarize, the project is meeting or exceeding its the goals of success laid out for it, with the exception of the injury, and we are on time and ahead of budget?
That's correct at this time. So, yes, I...
Knock on wood.
The contractor and the Bureau of Environmental Services together are performing admirably on the project. So, would also hope that you will take some time to recognize the contribution that Tuck Wilson has made to the committee up to this point. Basically, he, with his organizational skills and just his drive to make sure that the committee succeeded, has laid a good foundation for the committee, has made sure that we are well organized, that our meetings have run smoothly, and just would like to ask you to commend Tuck for all of the time and effort that he's put in. He put in a lot of time above and beyond just the meetings in organizing our reports and making sure that the meetings were scheduled and held. So he's just done an outstanding job, and I'm have been privileged to serve with Tuck, and hope that I can carry on the work of the committee from my standpoint.
I'm sure you will. Thanks, Bill.
Anyone signed to testify on this matter?
It's listed as a presentation.
Okay. It's a presentation. There's no council.
Well, I did have some questions.
Oh, you have some questions? Dean?
Dean. And
could you folks stay around just for a second? We have a couple of questions from the commissioners.
So that was a great presentation, I guess. And having had dinner last night with the mayor of Atlanta, she is very well versed in issues around sewers and water and parks. She lives, eats, and breathes this as we do. But I guess I wanted to ask you, where are we on the, what is the process currently that exists with respect to the location of the Selwood pump station?
Commissioner, the Selwood pump station is one of those facilities that although it wasn't mentioned specifically on the slide, it is one of those other facilities that is necessary in order for all of this to work.
Right.
We have picked a preferred location for the Selwood pump station. It is necessary to control the outfall there that happens at the Portland Rowing Club. We are negotiating with the Portland Rowing Club that owns the land in order to site the facility. We are creating a citizens advisory committee to assist us with the issues associated with building any kind of a facility, the appearance of the facility, how the facility would be built, what construction techniques, hours of construction, routing of construction equipment, and so on. So we are engaged right now with putting together that committee. There are some issues associated with neighbors to the site who would prefer that property to remain open space as opposed to having anything built on it. We're doing the best we can to address their questions. I'm not sure we'll be able to.
I guess there was some concern that they had never really been contacted, I guess because they live in condominiums that are gated or whatever, that they were not able to have flyers put under their doors. Apparently the building manager never delivered. So I think there's some currency to the point that they learned about this too late, at least as it's been presented to me. So
right, that's a good point. There was a
so they're coming late and they're feeling
meeting.
Like it's they didn't have a chance to have proper input.
Yes, I have actually met with several people who live in the condominium complex. I invited them to come in and talk with me, and they did, and I spent over an hour with them. Mm-hmm. Listening to their concerns. You're right. The initial communication with the individual owners of the condominium units was not what up to the standard we like to follow. We contacted the resident, the manager of the complex. They did not circulate the notices, so we went back and made the individual outreach to each condominium owner. That happened after the public meeting, so they did not get notice to the public meeting. Some of them feel that substantially disadvantaged them. I tried to assure them in the meeting that I had with them that while they did miss an interesting public meeting, we don't have public meetings in order to have a plebiscite on where to site facilities like pump stations. And so I wanted to assure them personally that their concerns were being taken seriously, that we realize that a public facility like a sewer pumping station being built near your home is something that we take seriously, and I certainly can appreciate their concerns. I'm hopeful that we will be able to work through this in the next few months.
So one of the things I've told Dean and the Bureau is, in addition to putting together the citizen committee oversight, is if that they're also going to, because we did screw up on the notification to the multiplex, that if the citizen oversight wants to have an additional public hearing with additional notification, we will. And so really putting the citizens in charge of this. We have a certain area of town we have to locate this thing in. And no matter where we locate it, there are going to be people that are going to be upset. But putting the citizens in charge of the process for coming up with the best option, the best recommendation back to us, I thought was really important. So that's what we have underway. So everything up to this point.
So that additional hearing will occur?
It's going to be up to the citizens. The Citizen Oversight Committee to decide if I assume that they will. I hope that they do, but it's going to be up to them to decide what the any additional public outreach will be.
The other thing, Commissioner, thanks for reminding me about that, but also when we met with Commissioner Adams, he requested we go back to the designers to see if we can maximize the amount of the facility that can be put underground and therefore not visible from any location, and we're working with the designers to do that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Further questions? Thank you, folks.
Thank you. I just want to mention again that we'll be having a tour opportunity for members of the public and members of the council this fall. And we expect to be back for our next report in January and look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good work, Paul.
No council action required. Move to the 10 a.m. time certain.
Item 962, adopt the Sergeant Jerome Sears United States Army Reserve Center Reuse Master Plan and recommend redevelopment of the site for a mixed income rental and ownership housing development that includes permanent supportive housing for homeless single adults and homeless families with special needs and designate community partners for affordable housing as the preferred developer of the Sears site.
This hearing is going to follow this particular order. We'll first hear from the Portland Development Commission, then the Housing Development Center, then the Community Partners for Affordable Housing, and Carlton Hart Architecture. And then we will have open it up to public testimony. Commissioner Fish, did you wish to make a statement before we begin?
Yes, thank you, Mayor, and members of the council. We have an amended resolution that is before the council this morning. The amended resolution does not make any substantive changes, but it does correct some homeless data. Thankfully, we do not have 4,000 people sleeping on the streets every night. However, 4,000 people are without permanent homes, and they sleep in transitional housing, in cars, in emergency shelters, and about 1,400 people do, in fact, sleep on the streets every night. We've also corrected some data on the housing burden for people who make minimum wage, so that amended resolution is before you, and again, there are no substantive changes in the resolution. Mayor, as you know, 2 weeks ago, a resolution that you and I co-sponsored was placed before the council for consideration on the Reeves Master Plan for the Sergeant Jerome Sears Army Center. At the request of Commissioner Leonard, we set this over for 2 weeks to undertake a process of considering alternative sites for affordable housing in the community. Today, we've asked a number of people to make brief presentations to council to both reframe the issue in terms of the process that led to this hearing, to give you an update on the search that was undertaken and the results of that search, and to tell you a little bit more about the proposed project. And then we are looking forward to hearing from some of the concerned citizens and neighbors from Southwest Portland who are here to testify.
Please proceed.
Keith Witkowski, Portland Development Commission. So what I'm going to add is just very, very brief context to this. You heard from Commissioner Fish in terms of what's occurred in the last few weeks and the course of the direction the council's taken. And I wanted to remind you what we're going to be doing on September 15th is submitting a report to the federal government based on council's recommendations for two sites in Portland on how to reuse these bases. Back in April, the site in North Portland, you were recommending for the Oregon National Guard. The site to the south, as it stands to the resolution today, you're looking at potentially housing. When the federal government gets those materials, they're going to be looking at two primary tests or burden of proof or whatever you want to call it. You know, the first one is how do these sites address homeless services, self-help housing. Site to the north doesn't address it at all. They're also going to be looking at it in terms of what kind of return on their investment they can get versus the public benefit that's going to be generated from it. Because around the country, you know, if they can't achieve the housing goals, they want to make money off of these sites for the most part. And so they'll be examining those two pieces as well. So with the site to the south, we're looking at an appraised value of probably $3 million. As we discussed before, you've got the emergency services, PDOT, kind of staging area proposal that could get a full discount. You've got the community partnership for affordable housing proposal that you're looking closely at that could probably get up to 50% and address some of the housing goals that are also incorporated into the federal regulations. So that was essentially all I wanted to say. I wanted to hand it over now to Philip from the Housing Development Center to talk about some of the work that they've done in conjunction with BHCD and the community and others to take a really hard look in a very short period of time at what other sites are available in the area.
Before you begin that, though, Keith, I understand we have two letters of conveyance from federal agencies. Could you explain how that came about and what those mean?
I can try, and if I fail, David Sheeran will hopefully correct me. We have got, you know what, I'm going to just have David do it rather than confuse the situation at all.
Thank you. As I've mentioned to you before, this is a complicated process. My name is David Schern with the Portland Development Commission. We have two public benefit conveyance applications that have been submitted to federal agencies. One is from Westside, actually, I'm sorry, three. Two are for education from Westside Christian High School and Portland Community College. They were submitted to the Department of Education. Westside Christian High School received approval of 100% discount. PCC received an 80% discount approval. And then we also have a conveyance application to FEMA from the City of Portland for the Emergency Response Facility that received approval for 100% discount. And so there are several different conveyance mechanisms, and the public benefit conveyance mechanism is just one of those that the Department of Defense can consider.
Thank you.
Philip Doko, Housing Development Center. We are development consultants to affordable housing developers. We have worked in the Portland area for 14 years, developed over 2,000 units of new and rehabilitated housing. One of our services to our clients is to do initial site search and feasibility workup to see whether or not a site would be appropriate to further pursue as an affordable housing site. We were asked by the Bureau of Housing and Community Development to take a look at a list of about 8 properties that were suggested to us and to determine whether or not any of these were worth a further look as a possible replacement site for housing. I wanted to talk a little bit about what kind of criteria we're generally looking at when we look at an affordable housing site. One of the principal ones is to get an appropriate project size. Because of the funding, the public funding, which is often available to us, principally low-income housing tax credits, we need to get a project of such a size that will maximize the amount of tax credit equity that it can generate from an investor. At the same time, we're looking to minimize our overall development costs per unit and our long-term operating costs per unit. So in general, we're looking at a project size that's somewhere around 40 or 50 units is kind of the minimum that we're looking at as that break-even point. We're also trying to find a site that is permissibly zoned, and for the most part, that means a residentially zoned site that can allow one unit for every 1,000 square feet of site, R1 zoning. We also look at commercial sites and at times EX zoned sites as well. We want to make sure that we site a project in a neighborhood that is appropriately that has an appropriate neighborhood scale. So in general, we're looking at sites along major transportation corridors and not looking to place sites, projects in areas that are zoned for single family at a very low density and scale. Land acquisition costs are a very critical component of this. And in general, we're looking for sites that we can purchase at no more than $25,000 to $35,000 per unit for acquisition costs. Some of the other things that we generally look at, we need to get close proximity to neighborhood retail and employment opportunities for the people that are going to live there. Access to community services is always an important criteria because the public funding entities are expecting us to be able to demonstrate that the future residents are going to have easy access to community services. Access to public transportation, again, located along a major transit corridor is a key criteria. And more than anything, we need to find a willing seller. And willing seller means not only someone who wants to sell us their property, but is generally willing to wait a number of months because of the time frame that it takes us to line up public financing for site acquisition. Our clients don't have the kind of working capital that a private developer can plunk down to buy a site. We've actually been engaged in a site search in Southwest Portland and Southeast Washington County for about 2 years now. And in the midst of the housing boom, we've had a hard time finding large sites that would accommodate a good affordable housing project in this area that are not already in high demand by private developers. It's difficult to find appropriately zoned land in this part of the city. And the high market values and demand mean that we are often beat out in our competition for these sites. What that means is we're often left with the most challenging and difficult sites to develop, sites that have wetlands, sites that are brownfields, and are passed over by the private market. Like I say, we took a quick look, by no means exhaustive. We were asked to do this in 2 weeks, and it's not the kind of detailed look we would take if we were looking to actually pursue a site, but kind of the initial feasibility that we would do in order to determine whether or not a site was worth pursuing. For the most part, the sites that were given to us were either too small. We couldn't build more than 20 units on most any of them. So that it didn't meet our criteria for getting a site that was large and dense enough to be cost effective. Many of the sites were zoned R7, meaning you could develop one unit for every 7,000 square feet. And though some of them were quite large, over 3 or 4 acres, it meant that our site acquisition costs could be anywhere from $80,000 to $100,000 per unit, which would not make it feasible as an affordable housing site. I can, if anyone has any questions about any of the work we did, I can do that, but that's pretty much the extent of my comments right now.
Philip, I have one question. You identified a range of nonprofits and agencies that assisted you in this search. We also got some feedback from community members, correct?
Yes.
Who identified sites, and they were included in your analysis?
Yes, that's right.
Sheila Fink with Community Partners for Affordable Housing. Try to keep it very brief, but we are happy to answer any questions you have time for. Just to reiterate what Philip went over, and he had a beautiful map that showed all these sites. We really did look at everyone, and that's a small in comparison to what we've done over the last 2 years, which is look pretty seriously at 15 different sites in southeastern Washington County and southwest Portland. We tend to know what's on the market, which is almost nothing, and we also know a lot about what's out there that isn't on the market, and we try to get it. We spend a lot of time doing that, too. So we've talked to churches. We've talked to school districts. So there really weren't surprises. There's sites that are very small, as Philip maybe didn't say most of them were a quarter or a third of an acre. There were a few larger ones like Smith School that the school district hasn't given any indication that they're ready to part with, and it's a single-family zone in an entirely single-family neighborhood. So of the 15 sites we've looked at, just to give you a flavor of that, I mean, the last two that we submitted purchase offers through a very qualified broker we work with who's very confident and experienced, we were outbid by 25 to 50% by private developers that were doing high-end senior care facilities. The folks we serve are closed out of the market, and we're closed out of the market. Opportunities like the Sears Armory just aren't out there. So we did do the alternatives analysis, but we're doing it all the time. So what we did over the last 2 weeks is to supplement and not as in-depth as what we do. We're developers looking for land all the time. In southwest Portland particularly, there is little buildable land. We look at infill. We don't shy away from difficult sites, and I think you know that. The watershed was built on 0.65 acres, oddly sloped, triangular, surrounded by busy streets, a brownfield vacant for decades. Nobody was looking at it. We'll look at sites like that. We're happy to. So we didn't take the alternatives analysis lightly whatsoever. Private developers simply won't go through that overlay of working with 13 different agencies, state, local, and federal, and we're used to it because our financing requires us to do that. And so we're happy to do it when we can, and the process for the BRAC procedure is no different. We invest a lot of time. We've had no money to do that. We do it because it's our mission, and it's a long process that's barely started. I mean, we've invested a lot because we think it is a good site for housing, and we appreciate that you've done a lot of research to help decide whether you agree with that as a policy matter. We have need, and this is a way to address it. the sort of wisdom and capacity to break up the site. It would make your decision easier if it were, would it be possible to do so? I think Philip has explained in some part why financing and regulatory procedures would make that not feasible. So we did also look at that seriously. We do have smaller projects in the past. We've done some rehabs. We've done some new construction. The cost per unit is high when we do that. Again, with the watershed, it made sense to go up four stories. We were able to get the density. This surrounded on a couple of sides by single family, that kind of density just doesn't make sense. So the 110-unit proposal that we've recommended you consider is a good one. It mixes incomes. It allows those incomes to not put too many homeless or formerly homeless in any one place, to mix them in a community that provides support internally and externally. 103-year-old neighborhood house is blocks away and serves folks, and plenty of them already live in this community. So I guess one of the things we'd like to remind people is we're not bringing in someone else. This isn't about us and them. This is about us. These are the people who serve you your latte in the morning. These are the folks that work in banks. I mean, the folks who live in our units, 85% work one or more jobs. They are bank tellers. They work at Intel. They are us. They are not different, and they are not scary, frightening, or presenting safety concerns for folks, certainly not in a well-managed community or in a neighborhood that works together with the landlords and owners as a unified community. I know Multnomah is one of those because I live and work in the area. Hillsdale is as well, and so we're really happy to have opportunities to work in Southwest Portland to kind of redress this issue that there isn't a lot of buildable land and we don't have an inventory of units that help those folks that are closed out of the market. I know there's a lot of concern and skepticism whenever a development is proposed in a neighborhood. As NPR sort of mentioned this morning, things like Measure 49 bring out the strongest feelings we might have. There's really little that's harder to deal with than land use. People have deeply held values, concerns, and love their homes and want to maintain the quality of life that we enjoy in Portland. We understand that because as a community-based developer, we're there for the long run. We live, work, and do business in the neighborhoods that we serve. So we're really always available to the people that are our neighbors, and we consider ourselves, as owners in maybe a different light than sometimes private developers do. We're community owners. So in terms of how we integrate that, the watershed was a good example. We tend to do multiple community charrettes, and we've made that offer to Multnomah probably a year or two ago when this process started. They rightfully wanted to keep a process that was, I guess, had the integrity of not working differently with any one developer. I don't think anyone else offered that sort of charrette, but we would have been happy to do it then. We did that with the watershed before we had site control to say, do you want us to seek this? So again, I mean, we have a lot of good mechanisms and a great architectural firm that is embedded with the same values of getting community input and figuring out how to take all those ideas and use every one we can without compromising the overall design, because you do get a lot of different ideas that tend to compete with each other. So we appreciate all that you, the community, and everyone involved has put into this really difficult process over the past year plus. David would know.
Yep.
Maybe more than a year, I'm sure. And so we know it's not an easy decision, but we think that it's a great opportunity, and we appreciate the time.
Mayor, if I could just note, Sheila, we had three applications for housing on this site. One of them was submitted by the Housing Authority of Portland. I formerly served as the vice chair of the Housing Authority of Portland, think very highly of their work, particularly their work at the New Columbia. I will tell you, though, that what caused me as one commissioner to give you the edge over the HAP proposal was the feedback I got in Southwest Portland from people who are both your neighbors and people who have been involved with your various developments. The feedback I got, which was uniformly positive about the relationship they had with community partners. And I think that the partnership with Neighborhood House, which is just up the street and also has strong roots in the community, is important. So I want you to know, from my point of view, that was a tipping point in evaluating among the different housing proposals. But in terms of your values, I have to say that after spending some time in Hillsdale and meeting with both the Business Association and the Neighborhood Association, something that just blew me away was that when you had a choice of branding your new project there, the Watershed, which is really a beautiful facility, and you could have put Watershed as a signage, you could have put whatever you wanted, you chose an iconic sign that simply identified it as Hillsdale, which gives it the same kind of standing that we have in my neighborhood of Hollywood with the Hollywood Theater. And I just have to say, in terms of symbolic gestures, I think that speaks volumes about the relationship that you've attempted to establish with your community partners.
Other questions?
If I could, you've answered this with some detail and passion and citing actual experience, which I think is and local to the